Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. You can find the club online at commonwealthclub.org, where audio and video links to past programs are also available. I'm Jonathan Curiel, journalist and author of All America Travels Through America's Arab and Islamic Roots, and your moderator for tonight's program. Tonight we are lucky to have a very large and diverse set of panelists to discuss recent developments in Egypt. To my immediate right, Jamal Dajani, Vice President of the Middle East, North Africa, Latin America, and the Caribbean at Internews Network. Prior to this, he was the Vice President of International News at Link TV, where he co-created Mosaic, World News from the Middle East. Also joining us is Dina Ibrahim. She's an Associate Professor of Broadcast and Electronic Communications Arts at San Francisco State University. She's a former reporter for numerous news organizations, including BBC World Service Radio, NPR, CNN in Cairo, and UPI in Cairo. And also joining us is Michael Nacht, a professor and former dean of the Goldman School of Public Policy at the University of California, Berkeley. From 2009 to 2010, Michael was also the Assistant Secretary of Defense for Global Strategic Affairs under the Obama administration. And via recorded video, we have Kristen Schick, correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. She's been correspondent there since 2010 and has covered every aspect of recent developments in Egypt. We're going to hear Kristen talk about recent developments in Cairo and Egypt to set the tone for tonight's discussion.
I'm Kristen Schick, the Cairo correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor, and I'm here in Cairo where just over a month ago, the military ousted President Mohamed Morsi. While the coup took place just over a month ago, the situation that led to it has been building for many months. When Morsi took office, after Egypt's first free presidential elections, he won by a razor-thin margin, and so his popular support was not as high as he acted like it was. He proceeded to lose the support that he did have, alienating most Egyptians except his most loyal supporters. He didn't govern inclusively, and when he proclaimed himself above judicial review and rammed through a new constitution in Egypt, he alienated many of those who had voted for him just to keep his opponent out, and they saw shades of authoritarianism in his governance style. He also mismanaged Egypt's economy, and life grew worse for very many Egyptians as the failing economy just grew worse and worse. So during all of this time, popular anger was building against Morsi, and he proceeded also to misjudge the military. Morsi thought he had brought the army under civilian control, but he failed to see the warning signs and threats that the military would turn against him if it decided that was necessary. So when the popular anger against Morsi rose to the point that millions took to the streets against him and Morsi refused to compromise, the military decided it was time to step in. So since then, we've witnessed a standoff between the Muslim Brotherhood and the military, since the military removed Morsi from office and placed Adli Mansour in his place. The Brotherhood has held a large sit-in in Cairo, where they have thousands of people there for over a month, and they've refused to leave. And publicly, they say that Morsi is the president, and they will not negotiate until he is reinstated. The big question now is whether the military and the Brotherhood will come to a deal, whether the Brotherhood will re-enter political life in Egypt and continue to play a role here, or whether it will go back to being a repressed, outlawed, underground group. It's difficult to see how progress can come to Egypt if the Brotherhood is outlawed and punished instead of included in political life going forward. And so that's going to be a real test going forward to see what happens between the military and the Brotherhood. It's also really apparent from the events of the last month that the institutions that held real power in Egypt for decades, like the military, never gave it up after the January 25th revolution. So right now it's very apparent that the military is still in control despite the civilian interim government that they've appointed. And I think the recent upheaval illustrates the really long road that Egypt has ahead of it in taking power and putting it in civilian hands, taking it out of the hands of the military, the intelligence, the security apparatus, and putting it firmly into civilian hands. I think the other problem that this illustrates is that the most recent upheaval illustrates is that any coming government in Egypt that doesn't sort of address the economic and security woes of Egypt's people is going to face further instability.
Thank you to Kristen for that. And let's go to our panelists. I mean, she talked about, the future of Egypt. And the future of Egypt seems very much like the present of Egypt, which is to say not very stable. And there are a lot of players in this, of course, the military. If I could get you to talk about what you see the future of Egypt being. Let's start with Jamal Dajani.
Thank you. I think this cannot be answered by a black and white situation. I want to remind everyone, because this is a polarized situation, and we're seeing pro-Mursi or anti-coup or whatever scenario. There are people who are not supporting, who don't support the coup, and at the same time, they don't support the Muslim Brotherhood. So we should recognize that there is a segment of society that actually are stuck now in the middle. But the situation on the ground, aside from this kind of stalemate now where we've seen even today a member of the Muslim Brotherhood or supporter of the Muslim Brotherhood was killed, so every day, the situation is going to escalate on the ground, that I think the most dangerous thing is the influence from abroad, not just what's happening on the ground, because people talk about, well, it's the Muslim Brotherhood on one side, and then it's the military, but who finances what? You have regional players that are now, interfering in everything, from the Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and other countries, and even, if I may add, and I never have found myself in a situation to defend, the Muslim Brothers, for example, but the recent statement by Secretary Kerry, saying that this wasn't a coup is also a very dangerous, statement and feeds into what's going on the ground, because and we know why that statement was made, because if the U.S. acknowledges a coup, then we'll have to cut financial aid to the military, essentially, or financial aid to Egypt, which is really the lifeline now of what keeps that country running, along with the new aid that they have been receiving from, the recent commitments from Saudi Arabia and so forth. So it looks really very, very dismal at this point, because it is not just up to the Egyptian people, and the only glimmer of hope that might happen if we see some sort of a coalition government in the making, where making room for the Muslim Brothers to be again to have a seat on that table that accept it. Which doesn't sound at this, at least for now, that they are willing to do so. And this can go on for weeks to come. And frankly, the past 48 hours, the military, I think, made the wise choice by averting a bloodshed when they made, again, a statement that they were going to vacate all those sit-ins. And then they've done their assessment and they realized that this wasn't going to just happened peacefully. We have to remember there is still a formidable movement which is still represents 25% of the vote, even though Morsi, won by 51%, but the actual reality you have 25%. This is what he got in the first round. And unfortunately, it needs a miracle to tell you the truth to kind of turn it around quickly.
Dina, you're from Egypt and you recently returned there for more than a month. Can you talk about events there, speculate perhaps, based on your experience there, but both old and new?
Sure. I was there recently, just got back, and I did participate in the June 30th demonstrations against Morsi. That was not exactly my intention when I got there. When I got there, I had not signed the widespread campaign, the petition campaign called Tamarrud, or Rebellion, that was signed by up to 22 million, allegedly, Egyptians to try to topple Morsi by popular mandate, by popular vote. When I got there, I found myself lecturing my friends and family about the fact that we needed to respect democracy and that we needed to let the Muslim Brotherhood finish their term. And if we didn't like them, then we could vote them out. And that's how it works. But I found myself increasingly beaten down by friends and family who were saying, well, you have the luxury of believing that because you don't live here and you don't know how difficult it's been for us under the Muslim Brotherhood. Particularly my friends and colleagues working in the media and in cultural industries. I did attend a protest in front of the Ministry of Culture, and that's when this was following what was called the Brotherhoodization of Egyptian society. They wanted to ban ballet, and they were basically appointing Brotherhood members in key positions in government that also were going to influence society as well. And a lot of people were very disappointed in that. Particularly, I believe the last blow with Morsi's appointments was appointing the governor of Luxor, who was among the people responsible for a major terrorist attack, I believe, back in 1996. So, it's this matter of selective perception. You know, that's, I think, the biggest issue in Egypt, is that it's very difficult for people to empathize with the other person's views. And that's difficult all around the world. And that's our fundamental problem, is that you're either secular or you're Islamist. And that's it. You're right. I mean, it's a huge polarization in society, and that's a major hurdle that we need to overcome. And that's what I saw firsthand. I didn't realize how bad it was until I was there. And I found myself sort of swept away in this anti-Morsi fever almost. And I did end up participating in the June 30th demonstrations because I never voted for Morsi. I couldn't. And I ended up with a really tough choice back in the elections, where I either vote for the Muslim Brotherhood or I vote for I vote for Mubarak. And it was a very, very tough call. For me personally, it was a fundamental choice between secular or Islamist. And that's where I see Egypt right now. I mean, the way I see it is Mubarak never left. And to me, it seems very interesting that the Brotherhood took over. They won by a very slim margin. If you recall, there were two or three days where the results were not exactly clear. And so I think it kind of makes sense that the Mubarak administration says, all right, well, let's let the Brotherhood take over. Let's calm down the situation right now. And in a year or so, we'll just get rid of him. You know, because that makes a lot of sense. It kind of shows the Egyptian people that the Muslim Brotherhood were inept politically. The economic situation, which is a huge issue here, absolutely deteriorated. My sister works for the Central Bank of Egypt, and, you know, she's very, very depressed about the economic situation there. It's dismal. And so with the failure of the Brotherhood, what we're now seeing is people in Egypt yearning for a military dictatorship, for a return to some form of stability, a rejection of the Islamicization of government. And I think that that's a point that the Mubarak administration is probably quite happy that is being made right now. And we all know that Mubarak is a military man and that Egypt has lived under military rule since 1952. And there are a lot of people yearning for that type of stability. So I don't think it's an entirely dismal situation. By nature, I'm an optimist, and I do believe that a year from now, things will be a whole lot more stable. And they are certainly going to be more stable than they would have been had the Muslim Brotherhood continued. It's a very, very difficult, heart-wrenching choice that you have to, that Egyptians have to make. You know, either we're going to give the Muslim Brotherhood a chance, or we're going to go back to a form of authoritarianism or the sham of democracy that we were living in under Mubarak. And it's a very tough choice. But at the end of the day, if we want to see our economy improve and we want to bring every one of you back to Egypt, if we want to boost tourism, if we want to be able to encourage foreign investment, then we need a form of stability. And I don't believe that the Muslim Brotherhood is going to provide that as the leadership of the country. My hope is that the intransigence, the sort of the cultural lack of compromise can be eventually overcome. Because when the Brotherhood were in power, none of the secular liberal people wanted to work with them. And now, no member of the Brotherhood wants to work with either the military or a future administration. So we've got to overcome that. But we do have a roadmap, and we do have elections coming up. And the Brotherhood have proved to be the most effective at grassroots organization and the most effective at garnering votes. They've been very successful at campaigning, whether it's reaching people through mosques or reaching people through simple bribery. You know, here's some oil and some sugar and come vote for the Brotherhood. They've had established social services for decades in Egypt, so it's going to be pretty easy for them to get votes. And my hope is that they participate in a future government and they get the representation that they deserve. Even though deep down in my heart, I believe that religion and politics don't mix, but you cannot deny that they are a formidable force in the country. So in a nutshell, I really do think that we're on the right track. As sad as it is that the military had to intervene, I was relieved, and I shared Egyptians' sense of relief when the army stepped in. Otherwise, it would have been much more of a bloody mess than what we're living in right now. And so I think that with eventual support of the Muslim Brotherhood, you know, and if they don't want that, then that's their choice. They can go back to being an underground movement, and that would be unfortunate. But I do hope that the future of Egypt is a secular one, and that basically, we return to being the greatest country in the Middle East, if not the whole world.
Thank you for ending it that way.
I'm a little biased.
Professor Nacht, you know, you've worked for the Obama administration. You have a long history in world affairs. I mean, can you take a big picture approach to the future of Egypt?
Sure. Well, I mean, this is, I don't know if it's President Obama's worst nightmare, but it's right up there. I participated in the first election campaign in 07 and 08, and I can tell you that if I had had the opportunity to brief Senator Obama and tell him that a couple of years after he took office, there'd be a sweeping revolution across the Middle East and the Arab world, and the Tunisian government, and Mubarak, and Gaddafi, and the Syrian situation in Yemen would all be in a tremendous state of turmoil, I think that would have been my last briefing. They would have taken me out. Because, you know that things don't last forever, but some of these governments have lasted 30 years, so why won't they last 33 years or 34 years? And my own sense, and we have a lot of intelligence capability, as you know, that the intelligence community was taken by surprise as well. The speed, the rapidity of this sweep. And to back up a minute, I mean, you know, the U.S. has been involved in the Middle East really from the time the Saudis and Roosevelt met to discuss oil during World War II. And over the decades, the U.S. has evolved into a set of policies in which we support several countries in the region, each of whom are rivals or enemies of the other, including Israel, Egypt, and Saudi Arabia, and the Gulf states. There's a lot of inconsistency within that group, but it serves American interests to support all of them. Would the United States like to see democracy as we kind of know it sweep the region? Absolutely. But democracy means free and fair elections, bicameral legislature, a free press, an independent judiciary, freedom to criticize, and all the attributes that we're very familiar with. And you see that it's not very easy in that part of the world. It's not easy in any part of the world. It took the U.S. a while to figure this out. It took Europe a while to figure this out. The Russians haven't quite figured it out. The Chinese haven't figured it out. So why should the Arab world be that different, especially, you know, when there was this election with Morsi? That was the first election in Egyptian history. I mean, can you imagine?
In 5,000 years.
5,000 years. That's a long time to go without, you know, without practicing. And the other feature I would say is that this is related, American strategic perspective, obviously related to then what happened with 9/11 and what's happened since 9/11, right? And the U.S. has now been engaged in two really bloody, awful wars with Islamic countries in Iraq till recently and in Afghanistan till today. They're the longest wars in American history. A lot of Americans have been killed. Many more people in those countries have been killed. And it's not clear whether the ultimate success of our policies will be achieved there. In Iraq, we were just talking in the green room that 1,000 people were killed in Iraq last month. You get into Shia-Sunni conflict there. And Afghanistan, I mean, are many of us that optimistic that when the U.S. military leaves Afghanistan, everything's going to be wonderful? I don't think most of us are. I think what to the extent that the American people are paying attention to all these issues, what they're beginning to realize is, first of all, the Islamic world is very diverse. Very diverse. And it's not just Shia-Sunni. There's tremendous nationalist views. So the Libyan perspective and perspectives are different than the Egyptian perspectives, which are different than the Syrian perspectives. And I would even say that the split between sectarian and Islamist is also, I think, slightly simplified because there are many gradations within the Islamist community. Some want to use force and are jihadists. Others are opposed to that. Among the sectarians, some want to work with the Muslim Brotherhood and some don't. So this is a headache-inducing problem for the U.S., and the president has proceeded very cautiously, maybe too cautiously. His critics on one side say he hasn't done enough, and on the other side say he's doing too much. It's a critical part of the world because of U.S. interests there, and we're hopeful that we can contribute to the prevention of real bloodshed in Egypt. We've not been able to do that in Syria. Syria is a human tragedy of gigantic proportions, but Syria is a small potato compared to Egypt in the Arab world. Egypt is really the key element.
And it has been the key for many of those 5,000 years. It's still considered the hub of the Arab world, the largest, most populous country. So when Tunisia begat the Arab Spring, there was, I think, some shock that it didn't happen in a bigger Arab country, but then once it happened in Egypt, then the unpredictability of it, I think, maybe took people by surprise. I mean, Morsi, for example, was on the cover of Time magazine, and people who didn't really, maybe didn't follow events that closely, might have thought he was the first, he was the new Gamal Abdel Nasser. You know, he was a kind of a celebrity in some sense, gracing the cover of international magazines, but he really wasn't Nasser.
And Morsi, by the way, I don't know how many of you know this, he has a PhD in electrical engineering from University of Southern California.
Yeah.
Did you know that? You know, he taught for 3 years at Cal State Northridge. Mm-hmm. He was on the faculty.
Although now they're spreading rumors that there is a question mark about his PhD.
Well,
I mean, and this is very important, because you have to understand also how media works in the region. This is
right.
What I've actually been spending my past 3 years working with journalists. You mentioned Tunisia. I was actually, my first assignment outside here was during the Tunisian Revolution, arriving in January of that year, and then spent time afterwards in Egypt, Libya, Syria. So all these countries that you've mentioned, that's what I've been doing in the past 3 years. But the media plays a major role as far as not only reporting on the news, but also spreading rumors and innuendos and attacks and disclaimers and so forth. I mean, Egypt, historically, we can't compare, for example, Egypt to Libya, where we never had any sort of media there. I mean, Egypt historically has been a hub for cinema and production, etc. So I'm not talking about the ability to report on news, but the major problem that in the past few years that I've been working with Egyptian journalists, that we found was media ethics. And this is very problematic. I mean, if you remember, right after the revolution, the largest newspaper in Egypt, Al-Ahram, which day in and day out idolized Mubarak, all of a sudden, the day after, they made a 180 switch, and then all of a sudden they became pro-revolution. And therefore that's something, you know, to keep an eye on, because that's what really drives the sentiments in the country. People wake up one day and they watch something on television or read something. And I'll give you another example, which was the attack on the U.S. embassy due to that film that about the Prophet Muhammad, which is lousy production, and then all of a sudden the story became that the U.S. government was financing a film to defame the Prophet. Well, I was in Egypt when this thing happened. Actually, I was in Tunisia and in Egypt at the same time, within the same couple of weeks. And our office is in Garden City. In Garden City, this is where you have the U.S. Embassy, the Canadian Embassy, the British Embassy. And we were actually right in that triangle. And thousands of people all of a sudden they just marched, denouncing, what happened, and, of course, breaching the walls of the embassy. We sent our team to talk to those folks there. And most of them, not a single one we've interviewed, actually watched the film. Not a single one had an educated answer or an opinion about it, except that they've heard something. And where did you hear that? They either read that in the major media reports, or on television, where they did not contextualize it. They just put it out there. Or they received an SMS message telling them to mobilize and just go attack the U.S. embassy. So you could imagine how things can just turn on a dime. And that's why when you say everyone was taken by surprise, I said, you're right. People, and of course it started in Tunisia. But that's what's going on throughout the region. I mean, now one word take you left, another word will take you all the way to the right. And to me, the war of information that is going on is the most dangerous war that we're witnessing, the one that people don't talk about. You know, we talk about the death and the destruction and what happens afterwards, but and earlier when I was talking about the regional influence, and it's not played just in Egypt on the media there, but also you have all these regional outlets like Al Jazeera and others, and some they just do it for hobby, others are just they want to pour fuel over, you know, the fire, and it's really very kind of dangerous situation that's going on in getting people mobilized and angry about what they're seeing.
Dina, do you want to?
I want to go back to your point about Gamal Abdel Nasser, which is a very good point. And I don't want to say I fear, because there are advantages to military dictatorship, unfortunately. But I do fear that the next step...
I like to know the advantages.
Stability.
Stability. Yeah. Go back to history. Stability is the biggest one. And I believe that Egyptians are yearning for that. And Gamal Abdel Nasser was a very charismatic, powerful figure, not just in Egypt, but regionally as well. And part of the problem of the revolution was that it had no leader. It was sort of a faceless movement. And that's part of why it really wasn't able to take hold politically and to garner votes, because they weren't organized. It's sort of a disorganized band of different people who found it a lot easier to break down existing political order rather than build a new political order. When I was in the streets of Cairo on June 30th, one of the things I found alarming was that there were young boys with giant reams of posters of General Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, who led the alleged military coup. And they were being distributed, and people were holding up posters of the general. And when my father and I asked the cab driver who drove us, you know, to the nearest demonstration, what do you want to see in our future? And he said, you know what, Egyptians just need a strong leader. That's what we need. We need a strong military man to crack down on all this chaos and just get us back on track. So I really believe that Egyptians are on the verge of voting for a military dictatorship. This is going to be a dictatorship by choice. Not that I'm a fan of that. Let me just make that clear. I'm disappointed that our cute little experiment with democracy didn't work out. There are some serious economic reasons that really have to do with stability and also have to do with protecting the secular political nature in Egypt, to keep religion out of politics. That's another advantage of the military. I can't believe I'm actually arguing for this, but you can see that this is what we've come to, unfortunately.
The same argument can be made by Bashar al-Assad and the Ba'ath Party.
That's true.
The late Saddam Hussein, and that's what they would say, and, you know.
But I'll go back to a point that you made about the U.S. providing a military lifeline to Egypt, and I wouldn't categorize it as a lifeline. $1.2 or even $1.3 billion is nothing by today's military spending standards. And the fact is the influence of the United States is waning, not just in Egypt, but in the region entirely. And again, if the military aid were to stop tomorrow, it would make an impact, but not a significant impact given what you were referring to before with other Gulf countries providing money as well.
It's more than, by the way, it's more than $1.3 billion. The military is the largest employer in Egypt. It is not, when we think about the military, military is more like a corporation. They employ people, they own real estate, they own factories, they own farms. So there is also part of the entire trade agreement between the U.S. and Egypt. There is a big chunk of money goes directly and indirectly outside the $1.3 billion. There is also, you know, the U.S. aid, which works with, which also finances other projects. But you're right. I mean, it's a combination. I mean, the U.S. has some money on the table, and Egypt, it's in dire financial situation now. And if Saudi Arabia, and basically this is the game. That's what I was referring to earlier. And Saudi Arabia stepped in now. And they've decided to commit $8 billion. All what they've done, they're replacing the Qatari money that Egypt now is losing because Qatar was supporting the Muslim Brothers before, and now the Saudi stepped in to support, you know. So they're being played like a football, really, in that area by those two financial giants.
That's true.
Not just the U.S. and other countries, but there is...
But Egypt can then take that Saudi money and money from the Emirates and go buy military hardware from Russia or from China.
There are restrictions.
I'd like to remind our radio audience that you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and tonight we're having a panel discussion titled Egypt and the Middle East, What's Next? Our panelists are Jamal Dajani, Vice President of Middle East, North Africa, Latin America, and the Caribbean at Internews Network, Dina Ibrahim, Associate Professor of Broadcast and Electronic Communications Arts at San Francisco State University and a former reporter for BBC, NPR, CNN in Cairo, and UPI in Cairo, and Michael Nacht, Professor and former Dean of the Goldman School of Public Policy at UC Berkeley and former Assistant Secretary of Defense for Global Strategic Affairs. I'm Jonathan Curiel, journalist and author of All America, Travels Through America's Arab and Islamic Roots. And the Commonwealth Club has a tradition of taking questions from the audience. We are not going to have live questions, but audience members have been submitting written questions. And one question I think relates to the topic we just discussed, and that is political Islam and whether audience member puts it this way, whether the eradication of political Islam is imperative to political stability in the Middle East. Is there a kind of either or here? Professor Nacht, I wonder if you can talk about that or maybe related issues.
I'm not quite sure what the questioner means by political Islam, but you know, there are important people in the Arab and Islamic world who see the resurgence of a third caliphate. There are others who want to see an Islamist society within their country but don't have broader ambitions. There are others who feel that the customs and the religious beliefs that they hold are the only correct beliefs, and they're not tolerant of alternative beliefs. So in many different ways, those who are more Islamist in nature are engaging in politics either peacefully or violently. And I don't see that that is going to subside anytime soon. I remember when Ayatollah Khomeini came to power in Iran in 1979, and even before he came to power, when he was sending those audio tapes from Paris to the people in Iran. And the message there was, we have been repressed by the West for hundreds of years, and the Shah is just the latest puppet of the West. And the Iranian people have to stand up, get up off your knees, and show the true feelings of the Iranian people. And that view swept aside the Savak, the Iranian military, and all the rest. So there are enormously deep feelings by millions of people in the region that their view is the correct view. And I think you just have to accept that this is going to be with us for a very, very long time. Hopefully we'd like to see it moderated, peacefully, etc. But I think in every one of these countries, Islamists with a political agenda will be a key player in the region. And you have other groups like Al-Qaeda, non-state actors, who will seek to take advantage of this, who will seek to cause more instability. And, of course, you see this in the highly complex Syrian situation, which we haven't talked about, where, you know, the Americans are concerned about chemical weapons that Bashar al-Assad has in Syria that could either be used by Hezbollah from Lebanon, or they could be used by al-Qaeda affiliates in Syria. So these choices are not wonderful. It reminds me a little bit of years ago, back in the 70s, when Gene Kirkpatrick was a very prominent critic of the Carter administration. I didn't share a bunch of her views, but she did say something once, which may be a bit of a simplification. This was a different era and a different set of issues. But she said, in the third world, that's, you know, we're talking about the developing world, she said, we're looking for Thomas Jefferson. She said, but Thomas Jefferson, this is 1977, so it's an antiquated comment. Thomas Jefferson doesn't exist in the third world, she said. The only choice in the third world is right-wing killers or communists. And she said, my choice is with the right-wing killers. So whether you share some of these sort of sharp statements or not, I mean, the key point from an American policy perspective is the choices are incredibly tough and difficult, and nothing is easy. I'm sure if Barack Obama, liberal, Hawaiian, Occidental College, Columbia, Harvard Law, Chicago community organizer, if we sat him down here and wiped out what's happened since 2008 and said, we'll give you some issues, how do you think you'll respond? I mean, he would be flabbergasted, I think, of the decisions he's actually made. Because when you're in the government, the choices, if they get to his level, the choices are very, very tough. And there are strong arguments on all sides of the issue. And whatever you do, it could be a 51-49 situation. So, I don't know, it's not very soothing, but this is the reality.
So we have odd juxtapositions in Egypt right now. We have Mubarak being retried. We have Morsi, I don't know where he is. We have former leaders in the Morsi government being tried for essentially creating the environment that led to deaths of protesters. But then the Egyptian military could be tried on those reasons as well. Right. So
you have collaboration with Hamas. That's a claim against Morsi.
Right, collaboration with Hamas, right, in terms of getting out of prison in 2011. Morsi, before he was deposed, also, though, was trying to involve Egypt into the regional area and by stating his opinion about Syria, for example, that good Muslims should oppose Assad in Syria and so forth. And it is, Jamal, as you said earlier, a really not black or white, very complicated. And Dina as well. I mean, you know, the sort of liberal view supporting the military is something I don't think I would ever have witnessed in my lifetime. And here we have it on stage, which I'm happy that you're embodied that.
It's disgusting.
Yeah.
No, but so it is a country of a situation of contradictions,
right,
and how you're navigating these contradictions is interesting. Can you talk about one question from an audience member is this person's worried about Egypt erupting into civil war? We don't quite have civil war yet, but we have bloodshed regularly. But I'm wondering if you could just talk about that via your own experience there recently in Egypt. Start with Jamal.
I don't think Egypt will erupt into a full-fledged civil war like with what we're seeing in Syria. And that's because the Egyptian people are all interconnected in different ways. When I talked about the military, for example, many people who oppose the military, they have members of their own family, I mean, in the military, And this is big, including the Muslim Brothers. Actually, one of Morsi's biggest mistakes was to trust Sisi, because he thought, and if you go, General Sisi actually is a conservative, devout Muslim. Right. And so when he wanted, when he decided to get rid of Tantawi, and he was fishing around and thinking, well, you know, I can't get rid of the military altogether. I mean, this is impossible. Who can I bring close to me? And he handpicked General Sisi because he thought that, well, he's devout. He goes to the mosque. He, you know, he did Umrah. I don't know if he did Hajj, but he was very conservative. He's going to take my side. But then General Sisi's loyalty remained with the military. And therefore, even though we've seen some killing, but it's nowhere near anywhere, including during the revolution, you know, the height of the revolution, the numbers are in the low hundreds of those who lost lives or were injured. And even recently, when compared, as we've mentioned, as you've mentioned, 1,000 people alone just died in Iraq in July. In Syria, on a daily basis, you have people killed in the 30 and 40 and so forth. I think we're going to have some tumultuous time and we're going to have some death, but it's not going to be a full-fledged civil war.
I agree. Yeah. Jamal is absolutely right. That there will be very difficult confrontations between Morsi supporters and the military. But that's the short-term view. We do have elections coming up. And they will do well if they are indeed fair and free elections that are going to take place. The Brotherhood will do well in those elections, should they choose to participate in them. Egypt is a more homogeneous society than other countries in the region religiously. We do have a very important contingent of Christians in Egypt. And even though we are homogenous, and you know, it really is heartbreaking because we have a history of really getting along, whether it was Christians, Jews, and Muslims, throughout the 5,000 years of our existence, have gotten along very well. And that has started to break down very seriously. And it worries me a lot. The threats that have been made against the Christian community in Egypt are very, very worrisome, particularly by Morsi supporters basically lashing out at the Christian community for what's happening. So there are elements that are very worrying. But I fundamentally believe that, Egyptians by nature are very passionate people. They're also very kind people. And I just don't see them taking arms up against each other over this. You know, you're talking about families. Within the same family, you'll find people supporting the military and the Brotherhood and the revolution. And, you know, we still are a family. And, you know, you're absolutely right, Jamal. People will die. Morsi supporters will get gunned down, and they will be jailed, and they will be tortured. We will go back to the Mubarak era of absolute brutal repression. And it's ugly. It's going to get really ugly. But I don't think it's going to be the point of full-fledged civil war. I think that might have been the situation had the army not stepped in.
We have several questions from the audience that relate to Israel, and also one that relates to Sinai. And I'm going to try to combine these questions into one. Sinai has not gotten a lot of attention, although it has because of militants there who were opposed to essentially the Morsi regime at some point. But also recently Israel has sent in drones to kill suspected militants there. So the question relates to the importance of Sinai, but also, is there a kind of domino effect? Is Israel involved? Should it be involved or should people think about Israel in terms of what's happening in Egypt? Or in a sense, you know, is it isolated? You know, these are very isolated, separate countries in this case. Professor Nock, do you want to address
that? Well, it's clearly not. I mean, that region can't be isolated when it's just a few miles from one to the other. Israel has its own national security interests. It certainly wants it to be the case that both Egypt and Jordan remain in peace treaties with Israel. And I think there was some concern that Morsi might have begun to head toward modifying or ditching the peace treaty. He hadn't gone that far, but some of the things he said, the relations with Hamas, and so forth. You know, you had people, just think of it, just before Morsi, we had Mubarak in Egypt for 30 years, and we had Gaddafi in Libya, which is much less important, and we had Assad in Syria and the Assad family since 1979, but the borders were quiet. There isn't a lot of trade and investment and tourism and all that. It's called a cold peace, but it was stable. And I think an Israeli view, it may not be the only Israeli view, there are many Israeli views, is that if more Islamists came to the fore in these countries, then the likelihood for the struggle renewing would be much greater. So, in a bit like my colleague here, I think to the extent I can guesstimate the Israeli position, they would prefer, if it has to be that way, military regimes with stability but are largely sectarian versus Islamist regimes. I don't actually think they have virtually any influence over what happens in Syria, in Egypt. And they're not sure, I think, what to do either. I mean, it's not as though there's someone out there with an answer key who knows exactly how these things are going to evolve. I mean, we had hoped, even as recently as 18 months ago, that Iraq would evolve into a democratic regime with a Shia majority that would be completely tolerant of the Sunni minority. It hasn't turned out that way. We spent all those years fighting, getting rid of Saddam Hussein to basically produce a pro-Shia regime closely allied with Iran? Is this what we did? That wasn't the objective. You know, I don't know, I don't mean this to be a disparaging comment, but sometimes people say, if you're looking for the logic of the Middle East, think of the story of the camel and the scorpion. Do you know that story? The camel plans to cross the Nile River, and a scorpion says to him, "Could I hop on your back and cross over?" And the camel says, "No, because you could sting me and poison me and kill me, and I don't want to, you know, I'm not going to do that." The scorpion says, "You know, I can't swim, so I have no vested interest in doing that, because if you drown, I'll drown with you." So the camel says, "Okay, hop on." They get halfway across the river, and then the scorpion stings the camel. And the camel is beginning to sink, and he looks up at the scorpion and says, "Why did you do that? You know, they're both going to drown." And the scorpion says, "I don't know. It's the Middle East." So the kind of logic that you've applied in your lives may not be applicable. Different cultures, different attitudes, different societies, and they have their own internal logic, but it's not necessarily our logic.
And in all fairness, that story could apply to other countries. Some people could say it could even apply to the United States, but
yep,
that's for another discussion.
Yep.
But I'm glad, Professor Nock, that you brought humor into the conversation. It's not all about anger and so forth in Egypt. There is humor, biting humor, granted. They have the equivalent of Jon Stewart over there, Bassem Youssef, and I believe, Dina, that you spoke with Bassem for a documentary that you're working on. Can you talk about why he is an important figure now, and what that means, what that says about Egyptian society?
Right. What Bassem Youssef represents is freedom of speech, essentially, and the freedom to pursue satire and to do so without feeling threatened and like you're going to be repressed again and jailed for your views or for making fun of the folks in power. And so what he's been going through in terms of getting prosecuted and having all kinds of legal cases against him has really become really, it's symbolic of the threat that freedom of speech is facing. And, you know, even though he did get into a lot of trouble, he gets death threats constantly. And, you know, it's a very difficult environment in which he operates. What I admire about him is that he just keeps escalating his humor, and it just keeps getting more and more biting. And he had a field day, much like Jon Stewart did when President Bush was in power. But he had a field day with Morsi. He was just really ruthless in making fun of him. And I hope that that tradition continues. And even if we return to a military dictatorship, which is just speculation at this point. I mean, even if we do, maybe it'll be just a phase that will transition us to true democracy. You know, you don't topple a military regime as strong as Mubarak's and have it all be hunky-dory in 2 years. So maybe the military is a big piece of a larger puzzle that we can eventually get to a point where we have an administration that is Mubarak-like in its stability, in its relative respect of minorities and women, with its healthy tourism and economy, but at the same time respecting all segments of society and, most importantly, respecting that freedom of speech. And I think that the chaotic regulatory environment that the media had been operating under taught Egyptians a lot about what can be said and what can't be said. Jamal was talking earlier about the government media, whether it's the Ahram newspaper or the state television. And basically, they're still a mouthpiece of the government, and that's sad. But on the other hand, there are private satellite channels that broadcast all kinds of different diverse views. Talking about freedom of speech, you know, that's really what Bassem Youssef represents, I believe. One of the most remarkable things that happened on July 3rd, which was when the army stepped in to topple Morsi. Of course, like most Egyptians, we were watching TV. We were either protesting in the street or at home watching TV. And all of a sudden, all of the Islamic channels went black. They were just cut off right there. And my first instinct, of course, as a journalist, was to say, that's censorship. That is so wrong. What is going on here? And my father and I had another epic fight. You know, we always argue about stuff. And he said, but they're inciting. Right. They are inciting violence. You don't understand. These pro-Morsi channels and these Islamist channels are calling for people to go in the streets and sacrifice themselves and blow themselves up. And they're asking people to incite violence. They have to be shut down. They have to be silenced. So much like Bassem Youssef, it's this notion of, you know, where does the freedom of speech end? Where does the responsibility start? Where does it end? Where's the line that we draw between what you can say and what you can't?
So, Jamal, your specialty and focus is really on the media in the Middle East. And how are Egyptians navigating this through the media? Is it a lot of channel switching in a sense? And does media still have an impact on people, or are people essentially so balkanized that they follow channels that essentially confirm their own views?
Well, I mean, the most important thing to understand that people in the region are inundated with, I mean, if we're talking about still the most powerful medium is satellite TV. Mm-hmm. We have now close to 1,000 satellite channels in the region, not only... You know, when you're sitting in Egypt, you're not only watching Egyptian TV, you know, you're watching regional television. You also have international television that now also broadcasts in Arabic, including Al Hurra TV from the United States, which many of you pay for its support through your taxpayers' money, and you don't get to see it, but that's targeting the Arab world. And then you have BBC Arabic, and you have the Chinese now, and they have, France, Van Quatre, from, you know, Russia Today in Arabic, they're bombarded. It's not that you are lacking information. You're actually, it's adding, I would say, noise to the truth. So the problem that they are suffering from is really sifting through all these different reports. And then you have also high number of illiteracy in the country. I mean, a country like Egypt, you know, we assume everyone is who we see at Tahrir or in Cairo or the students. But when you go in, you know, south to the Upper Nile, you have a high rate of illiteracy. You have people who can't afford to watch television or listen, depend on radio. They can't read, and it's very easy to influence them. And it's very easy to manipulate the information. And I've seen it time and time again, not, you know, by, you know, bloggers, let's say, or I'm talking about professional journalists who command an audience, and whether they support the Muslim brothers, and they are very powerful people who have that podium. And so if you know, to make the story short, but it's not any different than here. People are, they live in their own silos. So if you were a Muslim brother's supporter, you're going to love those Islamist channels, and you're going to believe only in those people, just like people who listen to Rush Limbaugh and they think he's the god of all gods in this country. And then there are those who like MSNBC and the liberal view, and then, you know, you go to Fox and they're bashing Obama day in, day out. It's very similar there, but I would say multiply that by 1,000 degrees. So the attacks are more intense, and the twisting of information and you know, manipulating the information is horrendous, because it really causes death. And it causes attacks, and it creates hatred. As Dina mentioned, you know, for example, people spreading rumors about the Copts, you know, and so that kind of gets people all in a frenzy, and they would, you know, just the other day, I think a Coptic girl was killed, going to school or something like that, or coming from a theater. And so, you know, when they spread rumors, you know, the result is really loss of life, and it's very dangerous.
Hi, we're coming to the final moments of this program. I want to remind our radio audience that you were listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and tonight we're having a panel discussion titled Egypt and the Middle East, What's Next? Our panelists are Jamal Dajani, Vice President of Middle East, North Africa, Latin America, and the Caribbean at Internews Network; Dina Ibrahim, Associate Professor of Broadcast and Electronic Communication Arts at San Francisco State University and former reporter for BBC, NPR, CNN in Cairo, and UPI in Cairo; and Michael Nacht, Professor and former Dean of Goldman School of Public Policy at UC Berkeley and former Assistant Secretary of Defense for Global Strategic Affairs. It's a little early for this, but I think I'll ask for it anyway. Can you please applaud the panelists for their extreme insight? That was a little early, so we still have 2 minutes left. Time for really one final question, but it has to be quick, I'm afraid. Let's start with Professor Nock. Can any final thoughts on Egypt, any worries, any concerns, any hopes for Egypt in about 35 seconds?
Well, I mean, despite all the complexity, I think, I mean, Egypt will evolve as the Egyptians want it to evolve. I think that the domestic forces in Egypt far outweigh any external forces, the money, the weapons, or whatever. And we don't know how it's... Based on history, given that Nasser came in 1952 and basically suppressed the Muslim Brotherhood and versions of it right until Mubarak was overthrown, it appears that in Egypt, a more secular-oriented military is more likely to prevail, which would not necessarily be the case in other countries. But, you know, That might be wrong. But it's the best bet, I would say, as of now.
Dina, do you want to check in with final thoughts on?
I'm hopeful. I'm very hopeful and optimistic, and I just think that there's so many resources there that are eternal. And Egypt is not just the Egyptians in Egypt; it's the Egyptians also outside of Egypt, the best minds that have been sort of scattered around the world. And I think that it's all just a phase. I'm really convinced that things are going to get better and that we are going to be an inclusive government. Whether we go through some rocky times with the military, I don't think that exclusion is the answer. I hope that the Brotherhood doesn't end up being another repressed movement. I think that's dangerous as well. And I think that we can eventually come to a compromise.
And let's give the final word to Jamal Dejani. Final thoughts.
Just quickly, not just about Egypt. Most Arab countries received their independence in the late 50s and 60s. The French Revolution took more than 180 years to reach the Fourth Republic. So people's expectations that all of a sudden, whether it's in Tunisia or Egypt, wherever, we're going to just turn the switch and we're going to have a democracy is too hopeful. And it's going to take a little bit longer, so be patient.
Thank you once again to our panelists. Thank you to our audience.
Thank you so much for coming out tonight. We really appreciate it.
And thank you to people listening on radio, television, and the Internet. I'm Jonathan Curiel, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California is adjourned.